I am going to read you the name of some places.
Okay.
And I want you to tell me if you've ever heard of any of them and whether or not you have, like, what you think they are.
Okay, I probably haven't. I'm so bad with geography.
That's okay. Sue and Nan's.
Yeah, never heard of that. Is there a border of the area that I'm identifying? Just anywhere in the world?
They are in Chicago.
US? Oh, in Chicago.
Yeah. Edna and Regina's House of Fun.
That's pretty crazy.
Nope.
Ladybug.
Never heard of it.
Augie and CK's.
No.
So why was I at the Music Box Theater Sapapalooza programming, listing the names of lesbian bars to unsuspecting queer women? Well, at this point, I was a little obsessed with the mystery of the Music Box Lounge.
Sue and Nan's.
Sue
and Nan's.
No, I don't know.
Pat and Donna's Stop In Lounge.
Okay, I have a guess.
Okay. Do you want a couple more?
Yes, I do.
Edna and Regina's House of Fun.
Okay, well, if I don't know what this is, I have a great business idea.
The Music Box Lounge.
Yes.
Okay. The Music Box Lounge.
Okay, wait. Now I don't know. I don't know. No, I don't know any of these.
Can you guess what all these things have in common?
Are they queer in some capacity or, like, safe for the queer community?
They are, but they're more specific.
I did think that they were, like, lesbian bars, queer bars, great names. Music Box threw me off.
The thing they have in common is these are all names of lesbian bars from the 70s and 80s.
Oh my God, really?
Was it associated with the Music Box?
It was not affiliated with the theater, but it was here. It was in this location.
God, you're really? Okay, cool.
That's so cool. I did not know that.
Music Box!
Oh.
Welcome to Season 2 of Unboxing Queer History, a podcast from Gerber Hart Library and Archives. Gerber Hart is an independent, nonprofit library and archives with collections that focus on the LGBTQ history of Chicago and the Midwest. This season, listen in as we dive into our collections and ask questions about what is and isn't included in the archives. This season was made possible by Broadening Narratives Grant from the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and by support from listeners like you. Thank you. Today we hear from Quinn Rose as we explore the mystery of the Music Box Lounge and lesbian spaces in Chicago.
The Music Box Theater is a beloved institution in the South Fork corridor of Chicago's North Side. It first opened in 1929, but from 1977 to 1983, the theater only had sporadic screenings, and very little is known about this time. In 2015, they added an adjoining bar space to the storefront directly north of the theater and named it the Music Box Lounge. It wasn't until 2023 that this new Music Box Lounge learned about the space's previous life.
There was an email that went around in-house between some of the staff in February of 2023 around Valentine's Day. And Ryan, the main manager of the theater, was like, I think I heard that the lounge was maybe a lesbian bar. And that definitely piqued my interest right away.
That's Matt Kaysen, the manager of the Music Box Lounge. We sat down at Gerber Hart to go over the story from the beginning, how this hidden history was first uncovered, and where we found the Music Box Lounge in the archives.
And then I think around that same time, there was a tweet. It was an ad that was featured in this newer, Queer Chicago Lost Bars book. I'm going to blank on the name of it.
Last Call Chicago.
Yes. And that was kind of the first proof. You know, someone had taken a photo of it and tagged us on Twitter. So, of course, we bought the book right away. And there we were. And that was kind of the beginning. Gerber Hart was amazing, and, you know, we got access to, you know, the gay life, Blazing Star, I mean, a whole bunch of print material, and we were like, there it is.
The first evidence Matt found that the Music Box Lounge was ever a lesbian bar was an ad placed in the queer periodical Gay Life, which was reprinted into the 2022 book Last Call Chicago, a history of 1,001 LGBTQ-friendly taverns, haunts, and hangouts. We pored over every local gay periodical from this era we could find, and it started to paint a rough picture. The Music Box Lounge was a queer bar that opened next to the Music Box Theater in December of 1977, during that dark period when no one was paying enough attention to the theater to tell them they couldn't. One profile of the bar in the lesbian newspaper Blazing Star gave us a window into what a night there was like: pool tournaments, musicians, and a personal welcome from the owner Rhonda Renee, a charismatic former Las Vegas showgirl turned bar owner and professional wrestler. Based on the classified listings we found, it seems like her bar was only open about a year, a short chapter in her extraordinary life that's given us so many questions.
So this is Gay Life from January of 78, so just like a few weeks after it opened. And then it's infamous only to me and like two other people, but I think of it as an infamous ad.
Oh, it is.
The correction ad.
Yes, because the first one was ladies, a bar just for your lifestyle. And now it's like, correction, ladies and gentlemen, underlined.
This is so fun. I really wish we could hear a firsthand account of how this specifically happened. Like putting an ad in the paper for the ladies, mm-hmm. and then immediately taking it back. Like, this is not months later. This is 2 weeks later. We see the evidence of this in different places, that they had this kind of shifting identity where in some of the periodicals of the time, it was listed as a women's bar for a little while, and then it would switch to mixed gender bar. And then in a different periodical, it was listed as a mixed gender bar, and then they switched to listing it as a women's bar.
I assume all were welcome, and they just wanted people in the space and, to make money at the end of the day, but also a place in the community where, you know, all were welcome. I love the ad. We have an open mic night in the space right now as well, and we referenced this flyer and pulled the graphics from it.
I love that. I know you've been trying to bring elements of the 70s version like into the modern day version.
Yeah. I think the crazy thing was that we already were before we actually found out. I host a monthly bingo night in there. You know, we're definitely turning the looks. We're in drag. We're carrying on. But other things that have happened in the space too is, Rated Q, our monthly queer programming, has a cocktail hour before where they'll have a DJ and the queens will hang out and just kind of a space to hang out before, you watch the film. So yeah, it was kind of already happening before we found out that, it had happened in the space, 45 years earlier. So I think we were just kind of channeling it. It was just a very serendipitous, moment when we found out history was repeating itself.
One of the reasons why the mystery of the Music Box Lounge has fascinated so many people is these moments of serendipity. Like the staff of the Music Box discovering that they've been unintentionally carrying out the legacy of the space from 50 years ago. But one moment particularly stands out. Right as this investigation started, history decided to make itself known. Jen Dentel, the Community Outreach and Strategic Partnerships Manager at Gerber Hart, was pulled into this story from the beginning. Matt reached out over Instagram to ask if she knew any answers, and at first she thought she didn't have much to offer. But a trip she was taking that same day to pick up an unrelated donation changed everything.
A few weeks prior to this, I had been at Town Hall Apartments, which is a LGBTQ+ affordable housing unit in Lakeview. And an elder that I know, Marty, pulled me away to look at this collection that belonged to someone named Ricky Dollett, who had recently passed away. And so it was costumes and wigs and tons of photo albums of Ricky performing drag in the 1970s and 80s. So going back to that day that Matt messaged about the Music Box, that afternoon, Aaron and I drove over to pick up this collection. The manager wheels out Ricky's stuff in a shopping cart, and we're just picking things up to put them in Aaron's trunk. And I pick up a stack to put in the trunk, and this flyer flutters to the ground. And I swear to God, it's for Music Box Lounge. And I was like, are you kidding me? And so it falls to the ground. I look at it and I just kind of looked up. I was like, what is going on? What's happening? So it was just this kind of eerie, exciting thing that happened where I was like, okay, there's something here. There's some kind of mystery. And that's, I think that sort of eerie connection with Ricky, and I say eerie in a good way, that has continued throughout this. And I just have so many questions about Music Box. So,
the flyer in question is a charming handwritten collection of dates and names with drawings of drums, guitars, music notes, and a face with dramatic makeup filling out the space. It advertises live rock and roll music from Tees and the Geyser Dolls drag show featuring Marsha Michaels, the alter ego of the beautiful Ricky Dolit.
It's so funny, too, because this is, the copy we're looking at right now, I think, is like the original, and it's mm-hmm. pasted into a scrapbook. But then there was a black and white just photocopy that was made, and that's the one that floated out.
Oh, cool.
And it feels like it was trying to get found.
Yes. And it's definitely done with a Sharpie. And I love that they're using the imagery of like a music box with the notes kind of coming out and, you know, the text wrapping around. And mm-hmm. that seemed to be consistent in most of their marketing. I mean, a lot of the ads that follow in that, the gay life, you know, show the women that are singing, and, you know, they would almost have like a little residency, you know, mm-hmm. like for a couple weeks. But yeah, definitely singing live. I'm like, where was the stage? Right. Where was the bar? You know.
You came inside my clothes book, just like a whispering wind.
The Music Box Lounge featured performances from many queer artists, starting with a few weekends of Michelle Faith. Sama for Music is still available on YouTube, and this episode features a few of her songs, the same music that the first patrons of the Music Box Lounge would have heard in 1978. Do you wanna try?
I talk to like anyone I can, you know, any elder that I'm in contact with. It's something I ask about Music Box Lounge, and it's, I know someone's out there that went to it, and it's driving me crazy not being able to find someone. Though I will say going through Ricky's collection has been really emotional in a lot of ways for me, because in addition to Music Box Lounge, which we found a few more flyers going through his collection, I also saw that Ricky was friends with Miss Tilly, the Dirty Old Lady of Chicago, who was, you know, kind of my first love at Gerber Hart. We talked about her in the first season of the podcast. But she's another person where there's all these mysteries attached to her. And it just kills me that I could have talked to Ricky. We could have asked Ricky so many questions and learned so much from Ricky. And it just... the life that he had, it's beautiful to see these images from it. And he was involved in so many, you know, organizations. He was a hairdresser. He was involved in this really early, like, trans rights organization. And I just, it really kills me that it's such a brief, you know, if it had only been, you know, last year, or, you know, if we had just been a little sooner, if we had met sooner, I wish I could have talked with Ricky. So that's been a little hard.
I've had a similar kind of experience delving into this mystery as well, because we have a lot of the names of some women who performed mm-hmm. at the Music Box Lounge in its early months. And several of these women I've looked up only to find their obituaries from just the last few years. And we're really at this time where yeah. so many people from this particular era are passing away.
Yeah, it's very fragile and it's very... But yeah, it's so recent. There's something very heartbreaking about that.
Matt and Jen found so many hints about what the Music Box Lounge was like in the archives, and we started working on this podcast episode as a way to continue that journey. We wanted to talk about someone who actually went to the Music Box and could answer our questions. What did the space look like? How popular were the drag shows and live music performances? Were the sandwiches any good? But all of the historians and elders we asked had the same answer. I don't remember this bar. For now, we're left with only what we could find in these periodical listings to give us hints about what the place was actually like. But while I was looking for someone who could tell me about dancing to Michelle Faith under the Music Box's disco ball, Ansett found a whole collection of stories about the lively and beloved lesbian bar scene of the 70s and 80s. The bar names I found in the periodicals started to fill out into a whole history that I couldn't have begun to describe before embarking on this project. One popular bar, Petunia's, was just a mile south of the Music Box Lounge, close to DePaul University.
We definitely were at Petunias, and I think it was for a while there, the spot.
That's Marty Smith, who is already part of this story. She's actually the one who shepherded Ricky's collection to Gerber Hart in the first place. I got the chance to talk to her about some of the bars she frequented in the 70s and 80s. Within 5 minutes of meeting her, I learned a few very important things. She's part of the LGBTQ+ Intergenerational Dialogue Project. She's one of the coolest people I've ever met. And she was one hell of a pool player.
We used to play pool there, and it was also a dance bar. And I had this problem. There was this little window that I could play pool when I was just drunk. Just, you know, I was just an ordinary player, and then I would get this little plateau when I was just so drunk, and no one could touch me. Mm-hmm. No one could touch me. And then after about an hour or so, I would drink, because we never played for money when we paid for drinks. And so after about an hour, I could just beat anybody and everybody, and they would all try. And then about after an hour, and after about two or three more drinks, I hit this place where I was too drunk. And I couldn't beat anybody. Uh-huh. I was just done.
I was also lucky enough to sit down with three friends to discuss their intersecting experiences in the lesbian bar scene. Kathy, Pam, and Cecilia's paths overlapped at different points in their lives, but they all wanted to express their shared love of the community that shaped them.
I always liked Petunias, which... We have a disagreement here with, I have a disagreement with Cecilia.
And to argue about where some of those bars were.
She claims it had a big dance floor and was on Fullerton.
No, not Fullerton. No. I don't remember the street.
Maybe it's just the size of the dance floor that you don't recall correctly, because Petunias was definitely on Southport and Wrightwood. The north?
You know what?
The southeast corner. Mm-hmm. And it later became Deja Vu.
Kathy's first lesbian bar, Lost and Found, was an institution open from 1965 until 1980 in Irving Park.
My first bar, was Lost and Found. And it was just one of those experiences where there was a couple dancing, and of course it was to Patsy Cline and slow dancing.
Crazy.
The one woman had on like this really, really frilly party dance that you would wear to like square dancing. And the other woman had on a zoot suit with black and white spats. And I thought, well, I'm not quite like her, and I'm not quite like her. I might not be in the right place. But I stayed.
Cecilia's first bar, The Ladybug, opened in 1979 on the Halsted Strip, near where Replay is today.
For me, my first bar was The Ladybug. And I was underage, of course. But I had just left Mass, which was Dignity, Chicago. And a friend I was with was older, of course, and she told the bouncer was, "We just came from church," and for some reason she let us in.
They had a lot more to worry about than just getting away with underage drinking. Marty brought up dangers from both sides of the law, the police targeting lesbian bars and organized crime putting pressure on bar owners.
There also was a very strong influence, of course, at that time of what they call the outfit in Chicago, the mob having influence in a lot of these bars. And they had to pay, all the bars did. They paid the cops, and they paid the whoever it was, representatives from the outfit. And that went on until finally several of the bar owners just finally decided they were tired of making those payments, and they stopped. Hmm. You know, but they would have raids anyway. There were raids. You had to wear your pants backwards. If you wore men's pants, you had to wear them back. Or you would be cross-dressing.
All of the women I talked to shared so many fascinating stories about the bars they visited, and unfortunately sometimes the risks they were taking by even going to them. I wanted to know, why were there so many bars in Chicago at this time, and what was the political and legal pressure on those bars? To answer my questions, I turned to Liz Garibay, the executive director of the Beer Culture Center and a brilliant historian of Chicago, bars, and alcohol as a cultural force throughout history.
At this time in our history, women were so desperate, and it was so needed to fight for our rights. And it's almost like a lot of the lesbian activism got lost in that mix, right? Like it wasn't important enough for the bigger picture. And I think that that really was a catalyst for a lesbian movement to really move forward. And, you know, no matter how you identify, no matter time period, when you're fighting for something, you are trying to be with like-minded people in spaces that allow you to plan and strategize and figure out what's next. And so I think for this lesbian movement, bars started to play a really important role in all of that. And so, you know, now you're looking at a subcategory of women fighting for a different kind of woman. And so even, you know, maybe women who were more butch or were just maybe a little bit more masculine, you know, that they were constantly harassed on the street. And so finding these, you know, spaces like, you know, somebody's home or eventually bars, I think ended up providing some of those safe spaces. But, you know, you want to be with like people, you want to be around people who understand you, and you want to be around people who won't judge you in that way because of how you identify. But the world outside is still out there. And so, you know, the laws and the police often didn't make it very safe.
During the 70s, there was finally a sense of growing freedom for gay and lesbian bars. But the era of frequent police raids was still a recent memory, and the threat of law enforcement loomed over the bars.
Police had been ever present in not just gay bars, but lesbian bars, right? There are all these rules always. You know, the law would change so that raids could happen because there are rules. I think there was one rule for lesbian bars called like the zipper ordinance or something like that, where if you had a pair of pants that were zippered in the front, that was bad because it was too masculine. So you were only allowed to have pants that had a zipper in the back, right? Because then that means it was more feminine. And then you were maybe not a lesbian. Right. So our rules like this constantly. And then, you know, the raids would happen. And the thing about the police raids that was really ridiculous is that this is a time when being gay, being lesbian is significantly frowned upon and people are deep, deep, deep in the closet and they're going to these bars just to be themselves. And this is, you know, forced, almost like forced secrecy. Right. And so when the raids would happen and you would get arrested, your name could get published in the newspaper. So that means if your employer found your name in the newspaper for being at a gay bar, you could be fired.
I feel like I could keep asking you questions about this for the next 20 minutes, but I do want to, I think I'll shift gears a little bit to ask about kind of the other side of the pressure that was on gay and lesbian bars at this time, which was the influence of the mob and organized crime.
You know, it's funny. I've heard this question before, and I don't know too much, or I've heard very little about mob involvement in some of this stuff. And here's the thing: in that era, the thing that when people ask me about that, I say, you know, we really can't say that we know too much because these were illegal acts, right? And so people are not really trying to be obvious about them. You know, records of certain things are very rare to find unless you're talking about, you know, again, police raids or something involvement with the police and somebody writing something in a newspaper. So when I often talk about the mob from 1920s onward, I wholeheartedly say I can't factually tell you things about that because of the written record. Like we have some things, but we don't have a full picture. So I could never really provide an answer about the depth of involvement and the number of bars that were associated with that group.
There were challenges back then from even within the community. Pam and Cecilia both expressed concerns they had, ranging from assumptions about sex roles to racial discrimination.
I grew up in Niles, in the suburbs and ended up going to living there and going to UICC, which we just called Circle at the time. Just coming out and didn't know what to do, and basically the readers would help me, because then I could read about there were ads maybe for Lavender Woman, and I think I picked up Lavender Woman issues at Circle, maybe that's how I, because I had no idea what to do. I was clueless. And there was a list of bars, and the one that sounded the nicest to me was Sue and Nan's. Sounds friendly, right? You heard of that one?
Yes.
Corner of Lincoln and just south of Irving, a block or two. And I just, you know, went there a lot. And I was I was maybe 20, but at that time, they had changed the drinking age to 19 for beer and wine. So I drank Schlitz.
Yeah.
The bartender used to go, she was Nan, actually. It was actually Sue and Nan. A Schlitz-a-rooney for you. It's like, I remember that. Anyway, I was a hardcore feminist. I mean, I was... And that bar, I mean, kind of like Lost and Found, like a butch femme kind of bar. Yeah. I don't know what the actual term was. I mean, it was still fun going there, but I would go there wearing flannel shirts and work boots. And because at that time I had long hair, the butches wouldn't leave me alone. They would try to pick me up. They would not. They saw past what I was wearing. It's like the long hair was it. She's a femme. It's like all I wanted to do was to get away from any kind of sex roles. And then you end up in a bar like that. Like, you've probably felt exactly the same at Lost and Found.
No, I'd be remiss in not saying that as a person of color, sometimes it was difficult at certain bars to be allowed in, you know. And most of the time it happened to the African-American women, you know, and sometimes to the Latinos, Latinas.
That's true. There weren't many black women at the bars. Certain bars would have more. Mm-hmm. There were some issues, I think, with Augie C.K.'s, where there
Augie
were some...
Augie C.K.'s was pretty bad about it.
I asked Liz to speak on these tensions, the separation between men and women's bars, as well as the racial dynamics in lesbian bars. Chicago was and is a heavily segregated city, and these issues don't disappear just because you've entered a queer bar.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think this is one of those things that parallels space and time, you know. Today, think about going to the bars today. You know, if I want to go watch a ball game, I'm going to probably go to a sports bar, right? If I want to go dancing, I know where to go. So bars that get established are known for certain things. And so again, within the LGBTQ plus community over time, you're already being different. And you want, again, those people like you to be in that space. So if someone else walks into the space that's not like that, all of a sudden, there's a whole new kind of judgment. And it's so layered. And so, I mean, you know, I wasn't around to go to the bars in the 70s and 80s. But when I was starting to go to a lot of these bars in the 1990s, in the late 1990s, I could see that. You know, I could see that, you know, I would maybe not be welcome in certain spaces, or in spaces that I was in, other people might not be welcome. And I think there was a connection to, we're fighting so hard just to find our own niche that we don't have room for somebody else, which, you know, saying it out loud like that is ridiculous, right? There's always room for someone at the Thanksgiving table, right? So you definitely saw that. And of course, it wasn't just about, you know, dressing or about ethnicity. It was literally about kind of like everything. And, you know, certainly in the 90s, and I know that this was the case in some of the lesbian bars in the 70s and 80s, just because of some of the folks that I've spoken to over time, is that aside from being welcome, I mean, there was certainly this divide between gay men and lesbians in those spaces, right? Like, women going into gay bars was sometimes a big no-no. And of course, men going into a lesbian bar, forget about it.
Lesbian bars had their fair share of tension, incidents, and bad actors. But amongst these issues, they were essential places of connection for a community that had been searching for that for a long time. Cecilia kept visiting the Ladybug, the bar that let her in after she came from church. She didn't know she would meet someone there who would change her life.
One day I go to the Ladybug to have a beer, and there's this woman there. And I don't sit right next to her, I just sit one stool over. And we start talking, and she's very nice. I wasn't trying to do anything, you know, doing anything. And I guess she had her girlfriend at the time came over and kissed her just to put a mark on her. You know, this is, she's mine. Walks away, you know, and leaves her there. Then I thought, oh, my God, I thought you were a nice person. But anyway, but so years later, we meet again, and we're on the same volleyball team. And that's when we got together, and then yeah, it was the and then Lady Lost and Found was where we had our first dance and kiss. So
oh wow, yeah.
Were you dancing to Patsy Cline?
No, Frank Sinatra.
Frank's
Strangers in the Night.
It was just such a different environment. I mean. Yes. I mean, we were all like on volleyball or softball teams, and mostly. I mean, I played with Pam, and you were affiliated with different teams, and I mean, and they were sponsored by the bars, so we would all go back to the bars and drink great quantities
to support them because they were sponsoring the teams.
Absolutely. Of course,
and
then
money for the teams.
You know,
so.
I mean, it was the entire center of our social life. It was absolutely the softball field and then the bar. That was it. I guess I feel kind of sad that you didn't experience all of the goings on, and the variety of things that you could do. I kind of feel like you guys missed out, and I'm sorry for that. You know, I really am. I mean, it was fun. It was fun.
2, 4, 6, 8. Yeah, it's just as good as straight.
One thing that surprised me in all of these conversations was that everyone had a question for me. Where are young people going today? Recently, the Lesbian Bar Project brought widespread attention to the fact that hundreds of lesbian bars have closed in the United States, with only 37 open today. But in the past few years, we've also seen a renewed demand for spaces for queer women, including a resurgence of lesbian bars. In Chicago, Nobody's Darling and Dorothy have opened in the last few years and are paving the way in dedicated sapphic nightlife spaces for a new generation. I talked to one of the co-founders and owners of Dorothy, Whitney Lamora, about how the bar came to be such a community event-focused space.
You know, I have a background in theater. I moved to Chicago about 16 years ago to pursue theater, did that for a few years, and then pivoted into the event scene. So I've been producing events on my own for well over a decade. And once we essentially came out of the quarantine period, you know, I was running pre-COVID, I was running my own independent event storefront called The Martin in the Humboldt Park neighborhood. In late 2021, I started hosting events and approached my friend Rain, who I had known from the previous Martin iteration, and really shared with them, you know, I was like, you know, things are starting to pick up. I'm interested in getting an open mic going, but, you know, I really need a host. I can't produce and host everything. And Rain immediately was like, I want to do it. And we started hosting Fruit Salad in October of 2021. So it started to be known as an event space. It started to be known as a queer space. And it had this like very popular sellout event that was happening without the bar being open. So by the time we opened, we were obviously continuing with Fruit Salad. We held a burlesque show right away, and then it just kind of started happening. So, I mean, I'm so privileged that this is my full-time job. So I spend, you know, most of my days and weeks like working with producers, building events, coaching those producers to put up the best event that they can in our space. And constantly I'm keeping my eyes and ears out for like, what's trendy, what's cool, you know, talking to our staff, developing things with our staff and our community. So, you know, queer spaces, naturally, if they're done right, are community spaces. And so we're just simply tapping into the creative aspect of our community to really hone in on being like this event boom, and this really like home for like great, incredible things that are happening while also having an excellent hospitality and cocktail program on top of it. So it's pretty wild, but yeah, it's been awesome to watch it happen.
What's something you wish you could tell everyone about Dorothy?
You know, we still get messages to this day after being open for, you know, we're coming up on 3 years. People who identify, people who are in the queer community or not, who don't identify as lesbian, like reaching out, really being concerned as to whether or not they will be welcome in the space. And, you know, yes, we are a lesbian space, and yes, it is a space that we want to continue to be protected for our community, but we are also a space for all people who are allies and who do respect what the space is, right? And so, you know, when trans folks reach out and ask if, you know, if they're mask presenting, like whether or not they'll be welcome because they've had experiences in the past where they're not welcome, at Dorothy, we sincerely want everyone to come out and really live their authentic lives. If you're not down with our community and, you know, you're uncomfortable or you're just there to troll or to watch or to, you know, whatever, then of course you're not, it's not for you. But the people who are actually concerned and reaching out, 99.9% of the time, it absolutely is for you.
And what's something you wish everyone knew about lesbian bars in general?
Well, you know, a question I get asked all the time is like, why are there not more lesbian bars? And I think that people don't understand how hard it is to open a business, how hard it is to open a bar. And, you know, it's not been that long that women were even allowed loans. It's not been that long that like people of color, queer people were basically given equal rights. So let's not forget that we are still, every time that we walk into a bank and we're like, hey, we want to open a queer space, will you give us six figures to do it? That's going to be a hard no from a lot of establishments. I think the question should be more, how do we foster more lesbian spaces instead of like being just kind of bummed that there's not more? And I also want to change the narrative that there are more lesbian spaces than ever. I think the Lesbian Bar Project did an incredible job really highlighting and bringing that forward, you know, the dissipating lesbian bars to the conversation in 2020 and 2021, and continue to do excellent work today. But ever since they've done that, the lesbian bar population, including our very own bar, has grown. I think at the end of the day, it's incredibly invaluable to be able to walk into a space in your true authentic self and know that our team will never question you for it. And I think especially on the lesbian front, you know, lesbians can identify in all sorts of ways, but we have a very, to go into a space that's, you know, woman forward, femme forward, trans forward, and just be able to feel that vibe is awesome. So, you know, try to go to Dorothy one night and then immediately go to like a regular old straight bar the next, and you'll get it.
Alongside new lesbian bars are programming slates that bring lesbian nightlife to new and old locations alike. I started this episode at the Music Box's Sapphapalooza series of lesbian films, where I gathered with hundreds of people to cheer on a lesbian drag show and the camp spy classic Debs, as well as trying to see if anyone could recognize the name of some former Chicago lesbian bars or had even heard of the Music Box's lesbian bar history. And now the Music Box Lounge is not only honoring that history, it's building a partnership with Gerber Hart to bring Chicago's queer history to more people than ever.
May 2025, Elizabeth programmed a series called Sapphapalooza at the Music Box, which was a sapphic film series, and we were invited to table at a few of the screenings. And so what we did for Murder and Murder, which was their first screening, and then for Bound, which Bound sold out. It was amazing. It was really lovely. Basically, we had two tables full of materials, and we brought materials from Gerber Hart that spoke to elements in the film. But it was just really fun to be able to bring materials from the library and from the archives for people to be able to stop by on their way in and out of the film to interact with the materials, with the idea that if they hadn't heard of Gerber Hart, this might pique some interest, and then they come visit later, they go to other programs. So I think bringing the archive out in the wild is really important to me.
Opening the door to the sapphic history of the Music Box Lounge and hearing firsthand accounts of so many other closed lesbian bars has been an amazing journey. But there are still so many unanswered questions. The people we never got the chance to talk to, other spaces with far too little documentation, the place has lost a history we might never recover. It feels like a world away and only yesterday at the same time. But as for today, we all have the chance to remember things a little bit differently.
We have done several events at Dorothy where we do like a queer elder history panel. We'll also bring a table of materials for people to interact with. We connect with the LGBTQ plus intergenerational dialogue project on these programs. And also with Dorothy, one of our volunteers, Caitlin, started this really amazing project called the Dorothy Living Archive Project. So basically, we are recording some of the events at Dorothy as the bar is thriving. So as opposed to typically in an archive, you get materials when like a bar closes or when a space closes, you kind of get what is left over or what someone thinks to give you. With this, the owners of Dorothy have been really wonderful at kind of tracking things as they go. So they've got a little box with some of the physical materials from Dorothy. There's a Google Drive, there's recordings of events. So it's something where we're able to kind of capture this really vibrant piece of lesbian and queer life in Chicago as it's happening. So the idea is that this will be a nice gift to our future selves in 50 years, that it'll be like, oh my gosh, we have records of this space called Dorothy, as opposed to Music Box, which we don't know what's going on at Music Box Lounge. We'll be able to see this was what was going on at Dorothy in 2024.
I'm really excited about that one in particular, because I think this whole project, as you pointed out, has shown us like how fragile history is and how much of it just lives in people's memories, and as opposed to anything that is written down or photographed. And to some extent, it makes sense. Like this was a time when it was a lot more dangerous. And so sometimes people weren't out. They weren't trying to record these things. They didn't want them to be remembered. And that is, I'm not trying to say that's not still true for many people today. But when we have the opportunity to record these spaces and to share them, that is such a beautiful gift.
Absolutely. And I, not to like be negative, but I worry, as far as like how ephemeral things are, I worry about now, just because so much is digital and so much is very fleeting. It's on social media, and I'm guilty of it too. You know, like I take so many photos of Gerberhard events, but where do those photos live? Like, how are they being preserved? Sometimes I think I just need to make scrapbooks, because God, like scrapbooks will last. Like, it's very easy to preserve photo albums. So I worry about like things are really vibrant, but how are we capturing it for the future? So yeah, I would say keep printing your photos is my takeaway.
Keep printing your photos. Next time you go out to a lesbian bar, write a journal entry about it.
Go take a little like photo at the photo booth at Dorothy. Write on the back of it the date. You're doing great.
Yeah.
Do that.
You have no idea how excited people 50 years in the future will be to see your ordinary day. When we first started working on this podcast, I think there was the hope that it would be like, and here's the answer. And instead, it's been a much more non-linear journey, but it does not end here.
Yeah. No, and that's, I mean, I felt that way about Miss Tilly, too, that we had someone come out after the episode and actually helped us track down who we think Tilly's legal identity probably is. But maybe there will be a break based on people hearing this. That will be someone will come out that has been from to the Music Box Lounge. But yeah, it's like you're hoping for a breakthrough, but then it ends up being much more about how these stories are fragile and how we can know a place existed. But that may be the only thing we can find about it, and how many other places existed that we don't even know about. So
I can't stop thinking about that, about how this mystery really got started because it shared space and a name with an institution that still exists. But how many other places are out there that were like this, or maybe even less formal places that it just doesn't have that connection?
Yeah, there's St. Sookie de la Croix wrote a column called Chicago Whispers for a really long time, and then published a book called Chicago Whispers, which is all about Chicago history pre-Stonewall, LGBTQ history. But he talked about he immigrated from the UK, and it'd be like he'd be walking past these buildings and these bars and like hearing the whispers of what used to be in these spaces. and talking to people about their memories of these spaces and trying to recreate these whispers he was hearing in the city, which I think is, you know, when you pass something that used to be something else and you know about it. It's like, I know this used to be like People Like Us books, or this used to be this. But unless you know, you know, I don't know. There's just a lot of history here. And I think it's really beautiful and eerie in a good way. So,
I'm going to title the episode Eerie in a Good Way. Because I'm happy with my living in a gay
society. Special thank you to the interviewees in this episode who generously donated their time and their stories. Matt Kaysen, Jen Dentel, Marty Smith, Pam Grossman, Cecilia Camarina, Kathy, Liz Garibay, and Whitney Lamora. And thank you to everyone who's ever shared the story of their community and kept the memory of lost places alive.
This episode was produced by Quinn Rose and edited by Mara Laser. Unboxing Queer History Season 2 is co-created by Aaron Bell and Jen Dentel. Special thanks to the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation for providing major funding for this season and for the support of listeners like you. To learn more about how you can support the preservation of our collections and help us continue unboxing queer history, visit gerberhart.org. Next time, join us as we explore the LGBTQ+ Intergenerational Dialogue Project with Chi Williams.
They were the only place. It was an alcohol-fueled culture. As I said, there were just very few places to meet. For some reason, you might meet someone in a library. I have no idea why there are so many lesbian, in particular lesbian librarians. I don't know. I don't understand that.